Welcome to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, and today I'm reading the August 2019 issue of The Guidepost. I begin with Finding Alice by Bob L. of Brooklyn, New York. For an alcoholic, the only relationship that matters is with the bottle until you get sober. I was diagnosed with terminal kidney cancer 2 years ago. I felt all the emotions you'd expect. Shock, dread, grief, self-pity. One emotion surprised me. Even more surprising, it turned out to be the emotion that outlasted all the others, growing stronger as the reality of the diagnosis took hold. That emotion is gratitude. I'm not grateful that the cancer might take my life before I even reach my 65th birthday. The gratitude I'm talking about is my astonished thanks for the happy, stable, and emotionally abundant life I will leave behind. A life I certainly did not deserve and never could have expected during the decade I squandered as an active alcoholic. Back then, I burned through 2 marriages and came close to wrecking a promising law career. I manipulated people, abandoned friendships, treated women like emotional props, and scorned help. It was another form of terminal illness. Today, I am married to a woman, Alice, who is more sensible, generous, and spiritually mature than I could ever hope to be. We celebrated our 27th wedding anniversary this year. We have 3 children. I recently retired as partner of a New York City law firm. None of this was foreordained, especially not my marriage to Alice, which I considered foundational after my relationship with God, to so much of my unexpected good fortune. I am grateful for Alice, and I am grateful for what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that enabled me to have my relationship with Alice. AA taught me how to find and rely on God, live with integrity, and think of others before myself. It taught me how to love unselfishly. Those gifts helped me keep sober. They also made me a better husband and father. Now that I am dying, I can approach the end of my life in peace because of who I have become in sobriety. I share my story in hopes that others struggling with addiction can find the connection and purpose that saved my life and filled me with such gratitude. I started drinking heavily in high school. I can't pinpoint why. There was nothing traumatic in my childhood. I'd grown up in a small town in north central Pennsylvania. Alcohol provided a respite from an undercurrent of insecurity I'd felt from the time I was little. I sought that respite often enough to get arrested for drinking at school in 10th grade. By the time I graduated high school, I couldn't have fun, couldn't get by really without alcohol. I managed to graduate college and did well enough on an entrance exam to start law school. I paced my drinking, staying more or less sober during the semester, then cutting loose the minute school ended. I got a job as an attorney representing a motorcycle company, facing multiple safety lawsuits. The best part of the job? Some of the clients were heavy drinkers, and my expense accounts paid for our booze. Eventually, I could no longer pace the drinking. My life spiraled into alcoholism's inevitable chaos and self-destruction. I drank to overcome insecurity. But of course, alcohol doesn't solve problems. It just distracts from them while making them worse. I got so anxious and stressed at work, I seriously contemplated quitting the firm and moving back home. There was no legal work there. It would have been professional suicide. My insecurity showed even more in my romantic relationships. I was terrified of rejection and gravitated to emotionally needy women, many of them fellow drinkers. I'd get infatuated, then recoil and move on. Or she would. My first wife, fed up with my drinking, walked out on me, leaving her wedding ring on the bathroom sink. My second wife, a fellow alcoholic, lost interest in me before the wedding. The events that led me to Alcoholics Anonymous, the collapse of that second marriage, my denial that I had a problem, the night I gave in, got on my knees, and begged a God I did not yet believe in to free me from the desire to drink, are variations on a theme known to many who have struggled with addiction. The hopeful part is what happened after I entered recovery. Alcoholism, I learned, is a disease of isolation. I thought alcohol made me more sociable by compensating for my debilitating insecurity. What it really did was interpose a veil between me and other people. Alcohol numbed my fears and insulated me from the hard work of building real relationships. As I began to work the 12 steps of AA, I was surprised to discover how many of them directed me toward relationships with a higher power and with other people. Steps 2 and 3 required me to surrender to a relationship with God. Steps 4 and 5 required a searching moral inventory and then admitting my character defects to God and to another person. The following steps went deeper. I had to make amends to people I had hurt, ask God to remove my shortcomings, pray often, and share with other alcoholics what I had learned in recovery. On top of that, I had to attend meetings and be honest with the people I met there. It felt so daunting after years of avoiding exactly this kind of connection and transparency. I had no idea whether I could do it, much less progress from sobriety to forging authentic relationships with friends and co-workers, or maybe, one day, a spouse. Here's what happened. AA doesn't just teach people how to forge relationships. In AA, you become a person who connects with others by doing it. The steps aren't just suggestions. Following them forces you to act. The meetings throw you together with people from all walks of life with one thing in common, addiction. What's left to hide? Day by day, step by step, I opened myself to other people, admitted my most shameful acts, and offered support to other alcoholics. After all those years of posturing and deflecting, I discovered a world I hadn't known existed. A world in which people didn't reject me when they learned the truth about me. A world in which love meant more than my need for affirmation. I met Alice 2 years after my first AA meeting. We were both on vacation in the Caribbean. Alice was pretty, like other women I had been attracted to. But Alice was also strong, independent, smart, and practical, and a woman of deep Christian faith. Even as we began dating back in New York, where she also lived, I found myself assuming she'd quickly see through me and dump me. That's where my AA experience kicked in. In my drinking days, I would have avoided someone like Alice or tried to manipulate her into falling for me. Now, I simply acted like myself and hoped for the best. I was driving Alice home one evening. Her face was unhappy, and the chorus of old insecurities started up. Here we go. She's made up her mind. She's about to dump me. I caught myself. Through experience in AA, I learned it wasn't healthy to try to read other people's minds. Everything okay, I said. What are you thinking? Oh, said Alice. I was thinking about my younger brother. He is not happy in his job. Surprise! She wasn't thinking negatively about me. She wasn't thinking about me at all. She gave me a sweet goodnight kiss when I dropped her off, and we made plans for another date. My foundation in recovery kept supporting me as things with Alice got more serious. In AA, I already had friends and an outlet for my hang-ups. I loved Alice, but I didn't need her like I'd needed women before. After we got engaged, she moved temporarily to Hong Kong to work as a foreign correspondent. Before recovery, I would have been devastated. This time, I prayed things would work out, relied on my AA friends for companionship and support, and made plans to visit. Alice came home, we married, and my initial decision to trust her turned into a habit that has sustained our marriage. Early in recovery, a speaker told me that if I truly wanted a happy marriage, I should focus not on finding the perfect mate, but on becoming the sort of person who would be attractive to a good partner. I've since learned the underlying lesson, make room for God to act. In addiction, and maybe this is true for all unhealthy lifestyles, I assumed I was the center of my own universe. Recovery requires a different assumption, that we are not alone and that we are not in charge. It's a great foundation for marriage. The more I trust God and focus on following His direction, the easier it becomes to love Alice without stifling her and to be loved without fearing the love will get yanked away. None of the usual stresses that can break a marriage work. Children, finances, big decisions, and the daily interactions that build up or grind down a relationship have managed to shake that strong foundation in God. Not even my cancer diagnosis has shaken it. Alice and I have cried together. We have prayed together. We have done our best to be realistic with the kids and prepare them for when I am gone. We have experienced the deepest grief. Our marriage has survived. And I am still sober. I keep thinking I am lucky to have been blessed with and loved by this woman and by the family we have raised together. It's not luck. I was a self-destructive drunk, driving my life into a ditch. I let go of the wheel, reached out to God, and gave in to recovery. I did the hard, halting work of learning to live in a new way. I made room for God to act. He's not done with me. I am grateful. And together with Alice, I am ready for what comes next. Healing relationships in recovery. Healthy relationships are one of the primary casualties of substance abuse. Addiction, above all, is a disease of isolation. Friends and family are hurt and bewildered by their addicted loved ones, self-focused, and self-destructive behavior. A major task for people in recovery and their loved ones is forging relationships built on trust, integrity, and love. Why does addiction damage relationships? And can that damage be healed? Alcohol and other drugs cause changes in the brain that severely impair a person's ability to relate to others. The addicted brain is preoccupied with avoiding withdrawal and maintaining an altered chemical state. A person with substance use disorder will lie, manipulate, and even break off contact with someone who stands in the way of maintaining that chemical equilibrium. Many addicts either are unaware they have a problem or deceive themselves and others to avoid having to quit. Alcohol and other drugs also impair reasoning and lower inhibitions, leading to emotional and sexual abuse, violence, and even criminal behavior. People with substance abuse disorders often have co-occurring disorders, such as anxiety or depression, which further isolate them. No one is obligated to remain in a relationship with someone abusive or dangerous, nor must loved ones tolerate infidelity or abandonment. In all relationships affected by addiction, loved ones should lovingly detach from the disease and practice self-care by reaching out to friends, family, support groups, and recovery professionals. A major part of recovery from substance abuse is learning a new way to be in relationships. People in recovery are encouraged to be honest about their struggles, take ownership of their actions, and make amends to those they have harmed. The accountability and acceptance found in support groups can promote healthy attachments and restore confidence eroded by addiction. No longer burdened by shame, people can forge more loving and transparent connections. A quality recovery program will also address the co-occurring disorders that contribute to addiction and impair relationships. Addiction damages relationships, but there is hope for healing. With treatment, people can become healthy and loving members of their families and communities. Dr. Randall Mullings, Director of Family Services, Karen Ocean Drive. The Human Chain by Jessica Simmons of Panama City, Florida. Help was coming, but not soon enough. My husband sprang the idea on me at the last minute, that Saturday evening, July 8, 2017. I didn't even have a chance to go into mission mode. That's our name for how I like to tackle things, from big projects like moving to everyday stuff like grocery shopping. I go into mission mode. I assess the situation, figure out what needs to be done, then do it. "Let's have dinner on the beach," Derek said. He must have seen me hesitate because he added, "a farewell picnic." It was his family's last day with us before they went home to Alabama. His mom and dad, 3 teenage nieces, and a teenage boyfriend. Derek and I don't have kids, and we loved playing parents for several weeks every summer. I worked at a hotel and cleaned houses on the side while taking business management classes online at the University of Alabama. I hope to run a business someday centered around helping animals. Derek managed a team that set up voting stations for federal, state, and local elections. A busy life. But making memories with the kids was our priority. We all loved the water, and we'd taken them to water parks, the beach, and kayaking. "A picnic on the beach sounds perfect," I said. "We can watch the sunset." We packed up the food, loaded everyone into cars, and drove to Miller County Pier and Panama City Beach. The coastline here is known for its 2 sandbars. The first, about 20 feet from shore. The second, 30 feet out. The trough between the sandbars makes a nice lane to swim in on calm days. But when it's choppy, look out. The waves can shift the sandbars and create rip currents. It was after 6 p.m. the lifeguards had left for the day. A yellow flag by the lifeguard tower meant moderate waves and currents. Pretty typical for the Gulf of Mexico. I wasn't too concerned. I'd swum in pools and lakes and rivers since I was a toddler. I was a strong swimmer. I could keep the kids safe. We went out to the first sandbar, where the water was knee-deep, so they could look for sand dollars. I looked up from the hunt and noticed a bunch of people gathered on the beach. They were all pointing toward the water. "Let's get out," I said. "Must be a shark." "I'll see what's going on," Derek said. He jogged over to the crowd as the kids and I made our way to shore. Derek waved me over. "There are people drowning. Not a shark. A riptide." There were maybe 30 people or so in the water. I couldn't tell which ones were in trouble. A police officer at the water's edge was telling everyone it was too dangerous to go out after those swimmers. Emergency lifeguards had been called. I asked 2 girls to show me who was drowning. "Over there," one said, pointing past the sandbars. "If you're caught in a riptide, you're supposed to swim parallel to the shore." These folks weren't moving. They were trapped. A man waded out to mid-waist. "It's too rough," he called back. The tide's trying to suck me in. I can't reach them." "We could just let these people drown." I knew what suddenly losing someone you love could do to a person. I had lost my first husband 5 years earlier. Matt had been in great shape, never sick, until a bad case of what we were told was bronchitis. It turned out to be sepsis. Matt just stopped breathing. I looked down at his lifeless body in the hospital bed in a state of shock. Coming home to an empty house afterward nearly destroyed me. I was only 23. I'd expected to grow old with Matt. What sustained me was our community. People reached out to me every single day. One of Matt's co-workers phoned me every morning to make sure I got out of bed. His two best friends took turns calling after work to ask about my day. My girlfriends came over to clean my house without being asked. The first Christmas without Matt, our friend Derek, now my husband, came over and put up a beautiful tree. I felt so loved. God put these people in my path. Their human chain saved me from drowning in my grief. A human chain, I thought. That's what we need. It was as if Derek read my mind. "Don't just stand there," he shouted to the crowd. "Let's make a chain." People plunged into the water and linked arms. 5 people, 10. Derek directed them. He was used to managing teams. Our nieces and the boyfriend jumped in to help. We put them in the shallows with taller adults farther out. Some folks didn't even know how to swim, but they put themselves in the line, relying on the ones beside them to keep them afloat. All these people who didn't know each other were working together. The chain grew to 40 people, 50, 60, more, but still not enough to reach the drowning swimmers. I grabbed 2 bougie boards off the beach and swam to the last man in line. He was in water up to his neck. "Can you bring those folks to me?" he asked. "Are you a good swimmer?" I could see them now, 20 feet away. 2 little boys, their mom, dad, grandmother, a young man, a young woman, a couple. 9 people total. "I'm really good," I said. "We'll get them out." I went into mission mode. I kicked hard, cutting through the churning water. The mom was on her back, trying desperately to hold up her sons. "Save my boys," she gasped. The boys were crying. I gave them the bougie board and pushed them to the end of the human chain. They got passed along to shore super fast. I took one of the boards and went for their mom next. "I'm so tired," she said. "You can do it," I said to her. "Just keep ticking." The last man in line grabbed her and shot her down the chain to safety. I got the bougie board back, swam the grandmother. She was in bad shape. The young man, the first woman's nephew, was holding her head above water. I tried to help her onto the bougie board. 1, 2, 6 times. She kept falling off. Each time the nephew dove down and brought her back up. But he was weakening. The grandmother's eyes rolled back in her head. I was not about to let this lady die. A surfer had paddled out, and the couple were draped on his board. "Can we put this woman on there?" I asked. The couple slid off the board and held on to the sides, but we couldn't get the grandmother up there. That's when Derek swam up beside me. He threw the grandmother onto the surfboard. The nephew curled his arm around her to keep her there. Then we waited for a wave to push the board to the end of the chain. I swam back out for the last 2 people, the boy's father and the young woman. She floated out of the riptide. 2 emergency lifeguards had arrived. They reached her and used the human chain to send her to shore. I headed for the father. He was a big man, 2x my size, too big to tow. "I can touch the ground now," he said. He walked slowly to shore. I went back to Derek and the kids. The human chain unraveled. An ambulance arrived. EMTs took the grandmother, who had had a heart attack, and the young woman who'd taken in too much water to the hospital. But both would be all right. Derek's last-minute picnic didn't give me time to go into mission mode. That's because God had a bigger mission in mind for everyone on the beach that day. Together, we saved 9 people from drowning, just as it had for me 6 years earlier. A human chain made all the difference. Still blooming, by Roberta Yoder of West Liberty, Ohio. "Do you want these?" my friend Christia Flores was cleaning out her shop's cooler to make room for her new arrivals one day last summer. The flowers she had to get rid of were still beautiful. I thanked her and walked out with a bouquet in hand. I felt a nudge to take it to my friend Gloria, who lives alone. As soon as she saw the flowers, tears welled up in her eyes. "Did you know it's my birthday?" she said. I had no idea. Since then, I've looked forward to whenever Christy lets me know she has flowers to give away. I secretly put roses on a neighbor's stoop, in another neighbor's watering can by the garage, and handed flowers to three other neighbors, all of whom happened to be elderly and single, or widows. One lady was so excited to get flowers, I heard her telling her cat, "The flowers I don't take, Christy brings to nursing homes. I think we get more joy than the recipients do." Thanks all around. "Let's find Cinderella," my 4-year-old granddaughter said during a recent trip to Walt Disney World. She ran ahead, then promptly fell and skinned her knee. Before I knew it, a cast member, Disney speak for employee, appeared with some ice, a slushie, and a colorful marshmallow treat. "Thank you," I said, but it didn't seem enough. Good thing I'd come prepared with tiny note cards on which I printed "Thank you for making our day magical." I got the idea when I was at our grocery store back home, and a checker was so helpful. I told the manager that really brightened the checker's day. Since then, my husband and I have made a point of recognizing those people who go out of their way to make our life a little easier. At Disney World, I handed out lots of little thank yous to the photographer who created the perfect shoot, the bus driver who sang songs, the cast members who delighted our granddaughters by calling them princesses. I even found that I could post a message to the park's official Twitter account at WDW Today with a hashtag #CastCompliment. It's easy and fun to show your appreciation when someone has gone above and beyond for you. Peggy Friesen of New York. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Mitch Albom. "No story sits by itself. Our lives connect like threads on a loom, interwoven in ways we never realize." Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott. And until next time, may we all be refreshed.